thousands of times bigger than our sun, are whipping around that object. The rate at which they move and how far they move from it, by way of the laws of Kepler's laws and Newton's laws, you can figure out the exact amount of mass of that massive black hole by watching things. We have watched time-lapse photography of stars in a couple of months or a fraction or a couple of years whipping around this black hole in the center. They're in a dance around it, if you know what I mean. Just like our planets are in a dance around this particular sun. But these are highly elliptical orbits that they're watching by way of radio telescopes looking through all the dust between us and the center of that galaxy. So we've seen the mass centers as dots. We've seen none of the details. By way of this event horizon combination of all of these very high resolution millimeter wave broadband telescopes, they intend to get a real, almost a photograph of that event horizon and the stuff that's now in close orbit around it, that's running very high temperatures and just about to dive through the point of no return, the event horizon, the Schwarzschild radius. It's got a punch.
Repeater, time out.
Schwarzschild radius. It's got a bunch of names, but they hope to resolve the details. And if there's any rotation and magnetic field, and there probably is, of that supermassive black hole, Cassie, most likely you're going to see these jets coming off the North Pole and jets coming off the South Pole, and the material squirting out from those jets. If it's there, if those jets are there, that material moves at close to the speed of light. And when one of those jets, if the star is rotating the correct way and one of those jets whips by your particular location, it's like a flashlight being swished in your direction. That is one of the explanations for some of the pulsars that we've seen. These jets coming off the edge, emitting, and the star rapidly rotating, and that's the individual pulses we're seeing from a pulsar. So there's a slight possibility that I think they're fairly sure that this is not a pulsar, but it probably has those jets squirting off the North and South Pole. Over to you, first Joe. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Plenty more to ask of this, so over to Paul, so you can hear the rest of the space report, because he's running out of time.
You've got it, Paul.
Very good, and there's a topic dealing with the pulsar that I had in a couple of minutes. But I just wanted to go over the EVA that took place on Tuesday. That was the day after this international space station contact that we had around Kakuma. And what they had was an EVA that wasn't scheduled, so they needed to do a repair. What happened was one of these MDM demultiplexer units, a relay type of box, a sergeant shoe box, had failed on Saturday. And NASA made the determination that, you know, there's redundancy throughout the space station. And there's two of these units. These MDMs control the solar panels, how they rotate, or they control the radiators, how they rotate. A lot of the external workings of the solar arrays, the way the whole thing rotates, the whole port side and starboard side, those things rotate on the alpha rotating mechanism. One of those probably as big as a Volkswagen. So they needed to fix this. This is considered a very important piece that breaks. Certain parts that break require immediate repair. So what they did, Saturday broke. Sunday, Peggy Whitson, now the commander on the space station, there's five people on board the space station. They had an extra box on board inside the station itself. And they replaced it, a card, an electronic card aboard was inside that box that they also had on the station. and once that was completed and NASA checked it out, that box was good to go. So that, they took outside on this 2.5 hour EVA. Usually EVAs are 6 hours long. This was an unscheduled EVA, and the time that they needed, they went out there, and she was the one that was tasked with the job of pulling out the old one and putting in the new one, located on the zero, zero structure, they call it, the main truss section, the center truss section on the 360-foot long truss, the main one right there, where they live on the Destiny module. That's where these MDM boxes are located, multiplexed boxes. She went out there with a drill gun with sockets on it, and backed out three bolts, took out the old one, and went to put the new one in, and had trouble with the gun that she was using. It looked like, when you saw a close-up, it looked like the socket must have been trying to drive it in. So Jack Fisher was out there with her, floated over, and gave her the new gun, and they were able to continue to make the repair. There was apparently some kind of debris, some kind of filing shape that floated off when they unscrewed it, screwed it back on. It wouldn't sink right. And then they hooked up the data box, sockets and the power sockets, and NASA checked it out while they were out there, and everything worked. Let me drop it. And while they were doing that, while Peggy was doing that, Jack Fisher, the guy that we talked to in Montacoma, was going to antennas, external antennas that will be used for future commercial manned flights when they go up to the space station within a year or so. So they floated back into the Quest lab and depressurized and came back inside and all as well. So what's strange is when you make her go on an appointment to have these contacts, you're really never sure. We knew at the last minute, within about 4 days, positively, that it was going to be on that Monday. But that could have changed. Saturday came, they had a fault on the MDM. Let me drop it. On Sunday, they did the repair inside the station, inside the box, before we brought out to the Quest lab. And then they had one day to evaluate everything on Monday. And Tuesday, they did the EVA, which left that Monday open. And we had a fine contact with K2FSH, Jack Fisher. So you never know how it's going to work out. You know, these things are planned way in advance. We're talking about, 10 months in advance. And you're never sure. You know the roughly the month, and then as time gets closer, you know the week. And I'm never sure, really, which astronaut you're going to be talking to. It could have been Tomas Pesquet, the European Space Agency guy, which speaks perfect English, or in this case, Jack Fisher, who only arrived probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. He had done one EVA while he was up there, scheduled EVA, and then finally he did the second. Peggy with him, by the way, she's breaking all kinds of records. She's got more time up there than most Americans, I think. In fact, all Americans. And EVA time, this is her 10th EVA. So there's only two people that have more time on an EVA than Peggy Whitson does. Let me drop it. Okay, on to the NICER story. The NICER is an acronym for Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, NICER. Being sent up as one of the components stored on a Dragon resupply cargo ship, which is going up June 1st, so a couple of days from now. space station, and robotic arm will install it and onto right next to the AMS, the Alpha magnetic spectrometer. Right next to that device that's been up there for the last space shuttle mission, which was in 2011. So this neutron star composition explorer, NICER, will be installed. And what this thing is going to do is look for pulsars, like you were talking about before, Dick, when we drop a WS1. It's really looking for neutron stars. Pulsars are really neutron stars that are spinning. And they have this terrific magnetic field, probably a trillion times more than the Earth. And as they rotate, like you said, it's like a flashlight. Because of this magnetic field is sending off particles. And when they interact with the Earth's atmosphere, you wind up with an X-ray event that comes off of that. Well, this nicer telescope thing, which is, has a, by the way, has a beautiful looking Azel type of setup where the thing can turn up any which way you want. It will look at the atmosphere and detect the X-rays coming off the atmosphere when one of these pulsars is looking our way. And, you know, before it comes and hits the atmosphere, you'll see low indications on a graph. And as it gets stronger, that's go up high and then that's down. Through this information, they can figure out the strength. They can figure out how... And they say how wide the pulsar would be, but what amount of time it takes to pass the Earth. And these things are spinning, you know, at super fast speeds. I forget how many times per second. So it's a highly accurate thing, spinning in space. So one of the experiments they're sending up was the Dragon cargo spacecraft being launched by Falcon 9 in June will be something called the Sextant. And what the Sextant is going to be using pulsars, not one pulsar, but up to three pulsars to detect its location in space. And they want to see how good they do with this. If they do have an accurate measurement of pulsars, they'll be able to, you know, where they're coming from, they'll be able to use these pulsars as a GPS type of coordinate. When you're going around the Earth, 30, 40, 50,000 miles out, we've had satellites that are able to utilize our present day GPS system. Let me drop it. But when you're going out to the planets, comets, asteroids, you know, you lose that capability. So we use star trackers that are on board the space station. We use signals from Earth, and, you know, there's all kinds of complicated schemes with gyroscopes. It goes on and on. If you could use pulsars that are out in space, which aren't going to move anytime soon, as permanent transmitters, triangulate off of that, you'll be able to tell if you're on a spacecraft where you are in space, either, you know, near Earth or near Mars or even beyond Pluto. So I thought that was pretty cool. Let me write that. There's a lot of topics. I won't cover them because we're running out of time, but we brought up the Electron rocket last week, and well, I brought it up in the past, but we were talking about it because it was supposed to be being launched from the North Island of New Zealand, and sure enough, it did go up. It's got a Rutherford engine, got brushless motors on the inside, driven by 50 volt lithium ion batteries that are connected to the motors are connected to pumps. Driving a pump at 40,000 RPM, building up the pressure, a couple of thousand pounds pressure inside the combustion chambers to launch these rockets. Now, this is a brand new rocket, brand new company. The company's been developing this stuff since 2006. So here it is 11 years later. And this guy, Peter Beck, has now succeeded in launching his rocket from New Zealand. Unfortunately, it didn't make orbit. It's a two-stage rocket, and he considers it a success. He has three rockets planned just for testing. No payload. What's on board is just, equipment to transmit data back to the ground. So apparently he's very happy with what he did launch up. He's got a couple of months now before his next launch. The goal is to commercially be operative and be able to launch, 300-400-pound satellites in sun-synchronous orbit at roughly once a week. That's his goal. So we'll see. But very good design. It's 95% more efficient than running a gas-fired generator system, open gas generator for the common rocket design. I think it's around 50% efficient. These things are like 95% efficient. So plans on eventually launching from the United States as well. Long-term goal. Back to you, Dick, any comments, questions? This is WS2N for the Space Report for the TechNet.
Anybody with any further questions for Paul on the Space Report? Give me your call letters right now. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes. Did you see 60 Minutes tonight, Paul, where the third story was about the inflatable room that was installed on the International Space Station? So that was on 60 Minutes, and I think you tend to record that and play it back later. WS2N, K2LIW, great Paul.
You're right, I will see that later. Just like I, what happened with Curiosity, the report that they had. And the reason probably for that is it's now up there a year. And that was one of my latest stories, not related to 60 Minutes, of course. But because they have been up there, they've gone into, they've opened a door to go into the beam, they call it beam. Beam is Bigelow, built by Bigelow Corporation. Bigelow Expandable Activity Module. So it's, 10 feet by 13 feet on the inside. So it's relatively small compared to the other modules that are up there. But it's a proof of concept. The system that went up one-third of the size. It went up on a SpaceX spacecraft a year ago. They attached it to the third node on the space station called Tranquility on the aft portion. And then successfully opened it up. Jeff Williams was in there, first guy to go inside and set things up and set up all kinds of detectors, radiation detectors. Since then, it's been visited by Kate Rubens and other astronauts that have been up there. And then just the other day, it's been opened up again. Let me drop it. For further tests, they leave it closed on a regular basis, I guess, in case something happens. The goal was to leave this thing up there for 2 years. Now it's 1 year. After 2 years, they plan on deorbiting it, let it burn up over the Pacific. But right now, it's still attached. They're doing a lot of tests. One of the things they thought about later, they're testing the radiation. They, comparing it to the module on the International Space Station. And right now, there's really relatively no difference. I think it's probably a little bit less. Now that they needed some kind of covers to go over the detectors. For some reason, they wanted to check. They want to put a different cover on it and see what happens, and then put a bigger cover on later on and drop it. Well, they didn't have the covers up there, so what they did is, what can we do instead of waiting for a space station? Oh, we got a 3D printer on board, and they do. It's called, it's a 3D printer made by a company called Made in Space, and they ran a they've made quite a few different things up there with tests and everything. They actually made a practical thing, a special kind of cover, not emailed up the data, and the printer printed it out, and they came up with this spherical-looking thing, and they put it over the detector inside the beam. They close it up, and they'll see how that goes. They'll take readings, and then the 3D printer's going to make a bigger one later on, put it over that. Scientists want to get an idea of what's going on. But I didn't see it yet, and I will we'll watch it. We've got a future date. No question about it. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
WH1Y.
Go ahead, Joe.
I did watch that clip on the 60 Minutes, and I didn't hear anything about what they said this thing was. Maybe I missed it, about what this thing is composed of, because what I'm just thinking of right now, yes, they can pressurize it and to get the thing to hold air, the same air as the space station. I can definitely understand them keeping the thing closed until they want to do something inside it, because if it gets a hole in it, you know, that'd be catastrophic, but what is this thing made of compared to the material the space station is made of? The reason I'm just thinking of that, if something not microscopic, but something of very, very small size was, you know, coming, you know, near this thing at a very, very, very high velocity, like something from, you know, just floating around in space that got started getting attracted towards the Earth.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And that kind of impact. Back to you.
Go ahead, Paul. When it comes to a micrometeorite impact and penetration of the International Space Station with its, I'm going to guess, aluminum panels we've got right now, and there's probably multiple layers of those aluminum panels versus this expandable material, have they discussed which one has more vulnerability to being punctured? Over to you, Paul, C2RIW.
Yeah, want to be in the beam if something like that happens. They've done tests with the aluminum structures, and it's the same type of whatever size thing they hit it with theoretically could penetrate the aluminum skin on the modules, and they'll just bounce off on the other. You know, they don't penetrate. They tend to bounce off. It absorbs it and then pushes it back out. And it's already been hit. They know it's been hit by different, you know, as things are getting hit all the time. There's a little crack in there, a little pinhole in the glass, in the cupola. There's always things hitting. So they know there's detectors in there. They know it's been hit. And it's holding up, they believe, 100% right now. And the goal is to send up a big one. Bigelow already has a contract with Atlas, for an Atlas V ride, with Boeing and Lockheed. United Launch Alliance will launch one of these things in a couple of years, much larger than the beam. You know, in fact, it's larger than the Destiny module that we sent up for the American drop. So that thing will, they want to put it up either independently from the space station, and they're really asking NASA if they could attach it to the front of Node 2, which would be Harmony Node, and see if they can attach it to that, trying to get the okay for that. Between 6 and 10 inches thick, that's still top secret. Bigelow won't release the information. I did the math on it one time. I came out with like an 8-inch thick wall. That was my guess, because they were talking about the interior and then the exterior, the diameter somewhere, and I came out with about 8 inches. So it's very thick, like a Kevlar, another strange name, I forget what an A, I forget what that's called. It's got, all kinds of insulation. And they say you feel it. It feels like concrete. It's hard as a rock on the inside or outside. Back to Dick and then back to Joe.
This material has to be bendable, and it's got to fold. So something that's 8 inches thick folding is really going to not be a simple accordion pleat fold. Those folds are, you know, folding inside of each other so that when you inflate it, it tends to pop as opposed to just slowly expand. In fact, the first two times they tried inflating it, I think it only partially inflated. And I think that it would go to a slightly higher pressure for a longer period of time before it fully inflated. So inflating it once it was folded and left for some number of days or weeks folded, put into space, and then depending on its temperature, that bendable material didn't want to pop into inflation right away. I think you saw that section, Paul, where it took 2 or 3 attempts, or maybe even 4 attempts, to inflate it. Over to you for a comment on that, Paul. KQRIW.
Yeah, they had astronaut Jeff Williams doing it at the time last year. And they were, the goal was to, they had 8 bottles inside, pressure bottles inside. And they were opening the valve to pressurize it, and to pressurize it to some degree that would open, it would stop. And they have these, ties completely around the whole diameter, and maybe 6 ties around them. And they were supposed to pop loose, pop open when they were pressurized, and it just wasn't doing it, and it was getting stuck, and they, like you said, they tried again and again 3 or 4 times, so they called it off for a day, and then they not came up with the solution of the job.
Yeah, I wondered, did they cut those ties on the last attempt, Paul, go ahead.
No, nobody did an EVA. But what they did is they said, well, let's just pressurize it. This was always an option, by the way, so they went with plan B. Let's just pressurize it with the air inside the station. So they have, you know, you have the equivalent of opening up a bigger valve, you know, bigger diameter thing to pressurize it. You know, the door was closed. They have big vent connections, which would normally be used, you know, for moving air from the space station into the beam anyway. So they open up those, I'm not going to call them vents, I'm going to call them valves, and they, you know, which allowed a lot of volume of pressure to go in at one time. And by doing that, it pushed the beam, and it expanded quickly and pop the straps that they needed to do, and it, you know, just went on from there. Worked out very good. What happened was this thing sat in Houston for in Florida for a very long time. There were delays. You know, the space program is always delayed when we drop it.
So it took a set. Go ahead.
Yeah, it took a set. Just put it open. It's you know, Galileo all over again with the antenna that didn't want to open up. It never did. Partially opened up. Galileo sat for years because of the Challenger explosion, and they never thought about, you know, a way to self lubricate things in space. So that was a failure with that. So that type of thing. Yeah, you leave something wrapped up too long, and it's going to be hard to unwrap it.
Now, you said there were bottles of air inside of this inflatable room, and from the outside, there's a way that they could command those bottles of air, compressed air, to vent and therefore pressurize the room. Is that what was going on, Paul? And where was the astronaut doing this control? I presume he's not inside the room. I'm guessing he's outside the room, pressurizing it and watching it expand. Is that true?
Yeah, I remember seeing it on NASA TV. Yeah, he was, you know, they had the door closed, and he's on the outside of that door. So he's opening valves and closing valves, pushing buttons, stopping buttons, that type of thing. You know, maybe the buttons closing solenoids that were opening and closing valves. I don't know. But, there were manual valves, and there were buttons he was pushing. I'm assuming the buttons probably attached to a valve. By the way, the door is not as big as the irregular doors all throughout the space station. Not for most of the doors are out, but the 2 inches wide, you know, they're squarish in nature. They're not round. And this one is squarish in nature, too, but it's a much smaller door. It's probably bigger than a meter. So it's probably around 40 inches, 44 inches, something like that. It's a little smaller door that they used, which makes sense because the thickness of the wall probably ate up some of that space they would have normally used back in the WS plant.
In the 60 minutes third session tonight, from about 7:40 to almost 8 o'clock, they showed pictures of much larger inflatable rooms he intends to build at a later time. And once you perfect the concept, just making a bigger one, sounds like all you do is make a bigger one. Well, there's a lot more involved. If you investigate something called the Laplace equation, and that determines whether or not you've got a spherical inflatable object or a hot dog-shaped object. In one case, it's radius squared, that's the spherical. In the case of the hot dog, it's radius linear. But as you make the radius larger for an inflatable balloon-like object, the amount of surface tension you create increases even for the exact same amount of air pressure. You've got a large cross-section on the tire of your automobile. 28 pounds of air gives that tire of the automobile a very high amount of surface tension and makes the tire pretty stiff, and the tire can hold up 1,000 pounds at each one of the wheels when you drop them. A tire with a small cross-section, like an English racer bicycle, you put 28 pounds of pressure in it, because the diameter of the cross-sectional area is so small, you end up with very little skin tension. You put 28 pounds of pressure into an English racer bicycle, and you will be riding on the rim, even though only 100 pounds is on each wheel. So 28 pounds of pressure on the English racer bicycle with 100 pounds on each wheel completely collapses the tire. The exact same pressure, 28 pounds, on a larger cross-section tire of your automobile gives it a lot more surface tension, and it holds up not 100 pounds, it holds up 1,000 pounds on each individual wheel. So you can see there's a relationship. So therefore, when you make a inflatable structure larger in diameter, you start building up surface tension real fast, and this is the whole reason why an aneurysm in the blood vessel of a human being is so dangerous. As the blood vessel expands, the pressure, the exact same amount of blood pressure creates more and more surface tension, and therefore it's a runaway condition. So these larger rooms he's proposing on paper look easy. To really make them stiff enough, to make the walls strong enough so that they can tolerate the extra surface tension created by the larger diameter, means that the wall has to be stronger and thicker, therefore more difficult to fold. So therefore, making very large inflatable structures has got some drawbacks to it. When it comes to the International Space Station right now, the metallic walls, do you have any idea how many layers there are to the metallic walls? So, is the metallic wall one layer of aluminum or two or three layers with some kind of a spacer in between? And the pinhole you've got in the window of the cupola, is air running out of that pinhole? WS2N, K2RIW.
Those glasses are very thick. So, no, it's like a ding that's in a, you know, what do you call it? Just like you would get on your windshield in a car, except it's very small, and I think you got four layers of glass anyway in between. So it's not even penetrating the first layer of glass. And the beam was 10 by 13. Bigelow 330, which means 330 square meter volume, is something like, oh, I think it's probably about 40 feet long by probably 30 feet wide, something like that. So, not a sphere. And then he had one years ago, but he backed off on that because everything was delayed for so many years and decades. 1,200 square meters, but that's even more of a stretch. So, I wonder if they showed Bigelow. He's quite a character. His whole operation is out in Las Vegas, and he got the approval to do this. Let me drop it.
Yeah, they did show his picture of a phone. Go ahead.
Oh, no interview. I'm surprised. I forgot it went out of my head. But 330 cubic meters. It would be able to hold six people. And then you put two of them together if you want. That's the goal, to put two together. More than that in the future. With an airlock attached to it, docking port. He's got big plans, this guy. If he can get this thing off the ground. Operates it, like I said, in Las Vegas. He's got them all set up. You can walk inside. You've seen him walk assistant NASA people on board. Oh, I know what I was going to say. The reason NASA accepted them. Let me drop it.
By the way, they did interview Bigelow. Show this picture and talk to him. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, okay, that's good. That makes sense. The reason they accepted him is because he's launched two independent spacecraft. They're still flying around. They've got solar panels on it. Still transmitting information back down to Earth. Pictures back down to Earth of the inside of the thing. It's called Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. And he launched them probably around 2006 or so, I would think. And then one about a year and a half later, he launched it out of Russia. He's got a ride on a Russian rocket. And they've really proven their worth. It's still inflated. It's still going around and around. So NASA gave him a shot, and it worked out. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, I think in his interview, he indicated that an awful lot of megabucks of his own money is going into these projects, unless I'm confusing him with some other gift-giving person. So I guess Bigelow is a fairly rich guy. You probably told us where his money came from, and a lot of his funding is going into this. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, he's the guy from Motel 8. Is that it? Motel 8. Pretty sure that's the name. And yeah, he made a fortune in motels. One thing led to another. If I have motels here all throughout the Earth, why can't I have one in space? So, he's a big space advocate, and that's what it takes. A couple of billionaires like that that are independently funded. Peter Beck with Rocket Lab launching the Electron rockets like that. You have Elon Musk, also self-funded with his Falcon 9, soon to be international interplanetary transport system. Plans on building a rocket big enough to go to Mars. And he's not the only one. You have Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon and Wall Street Journal, also building the, he's got the manned New Shepard being built, probably will test flight out at the end of the year with people in it, an astronaut to test it out. Rather, maybe a test pilot, but I'm going to call him an astronaut because he's going to go through the common layer into space. And he's got the New Glenn being built, probably a little smaller than the Saturn V, but not big, not much bigger. I mean, it's not much smaller than the Saturn V, but he's got that thing he's building in New Glenn, and that's all self-funded. Back to you, sir.
Slightly different subject. When Peggy Whitson was replacing that module, at first the bolts wouldn't go in. They got jammed or wouldn't go in correctly. And I forget the name of the other astronaut that was with her. He used something to blow the chips out of the hole. So I presume he had a can of compressed air. But think about this. He's operating in a vacuum. So as long as he takes the tubing that comes out of the can of compressed air and buries that piece of tubing down into the hole that has the threads where the bolt is going to go, the blind hole, which has got chips in it, then the air he puts in there is going to blow out those chips very nicely, even though there's a vacuum all around it. So blowing air to blow away the chips in a vacuum is a peculiar process. I wonder if you thought about that, Paul. In reality, as long as you've got an expandable piece of tubing, like you do with your this material that we use for cleaning engine parts. I can't think of the name of the darn stuff right now.
Wait. Gunk.
Gunk? Okay. That's one of the names. There's another name. It comes with a little red piece of tubing you plug into the nozzle, and it allows you to do cleaning. So as long as he pushes that piece of tubing down into the hole, even though there's a vacuum around, it'll blow out the chips very well, slightly more efficiently than it would with air around. WS2N, KQRIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, up on it was Jack Fisher on his second EVA. This is his first time in space, by the way. This is her third time in space. I don't remember them saying anything about blowing anything away. What happened was it takes three bolts to bolt down this MDM, and they got it. They thought the seating was not quite, and then they NASA had them actually unscrew it and they take it off again. And as that, when it was coming off, these little tiny flakes floated away. And then they, bolted it back down again. And a lot of time spent trying to get the right amount of torque. They know how many turns it should be, and, 23 turns, and, what kind of torque they have it set at, and they were having trouble getting to that number. They finally did, and then they were able to put the other two bolts in. That one rather quickly. The main bolt was a little tough. They claimed there was some kind of discoloration on the inner thread. So I'm thinking maybe it was cross-threaded to some degree. I don't know. Back to you.
Interesting. So Jack Fisher fixed that on his first EVA, and then it was able to seat itself all the way.
He finished his job. He came over and just bought the gun over.
He bought the gun over. Now, by gun, do you mean an impact wrench, or do you mean an air gun that blew out the chips? Over to you, Paul. How do you mean the word gun?
Oh, it's nothing but a fancy drill motor. Where they use the acronym. They have an acronym for it. NASA has an acronym for everything. Gun? I don't know. It's nothing but a drill motor, battery-operated drill motor, and they have put all kinds of different sockets on the front end of it. Back in the day.
So before they used that drill motor, how was she trying to put the bolts in the hole, Paul? Just by finger tightening?
No, it starts that way, and then they put the drill to it, and then they tighten it up. The socket looked like they 7/16. And I was surprised. I thought they were going to use the word a metric number, but I heard 7/16. Apparently, they made a comment. I was looking for information afterwards, but you can see the socket was relatively not in line after trying to tighten it up. So she probably over torqued it. Did something with the gun, or maybe pushed too hard on the gun. But the socket itself looked like it was bent in relation to the shaft of the drill motor. So at that point, they had Jack Fisher come over with another drill, handed it to Peggy, and she finished it off. So, but again, even with that, they took their time getting to the number. NASA tells them how many turns. They can dial it in or something, and then off they go.
Question?
Yeah, before that question, were these bolts blind fastening? Were they captured hardware? I mean, I can see you don't want an astronaut with those great big thick gloves handling a 7/16 bolt. The head is 7/16, the bolt is smaller than that, and dropping it, so to speak. So these must be captured fittings on this module. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
I think all that stuff is, I couldn't see clear enough. I mean, NASA could, but I couldn't. You know, they use the helmet cam, so they know what they're looking at better than me. They move around too much. I only could see so much. Joe had a question.
Go ahead, Joe.
You just listening to what you're talking about, it makes me just wonder about something. Maybe a very silly question, but sometimes you get the silly questions on here. You have an astronaut trying to put a bolt in and tighten it with a device, something like you use on planet Earth, all right? Motorized or whatever, it's going to turn it either clockwise or counterclockwise. What does the astronaut do to keep himself fixed in place so you don't have an action-reaction type of thing? Because if he's trying to turn the bolt clockwise, when the reaction of that whole thing trying to, you know, take him and turn him counterclockwise, what holds him in place to be able to do work up there like that?
I'm going to guess that they practice ahead of time holding on to things to stop the counter torque. Is that true, Paul?
Well, yeah, sure. They practice in the Johnson buoyancy tank. The Olympics are bigger than an Olympic-sized pool in Houston, down at Johnson Space Center. But like when they tighten things up, they're really going to tighten it up. They use their right hand and don't push the left hand. If they're trying to loosen something up, by doing that, they're able to keep more of their body weight opposing the turn. I've heard it described that way. And, you know, sometimes they're attached to the robotic arm with their feet. This way their body's not going to really go anywhere. And then they have ways of, there's railings all over. You can see when you look at the EVAs, there's gold railings all over. Each one is numbered. NASA tells them, you know, lock in. Naturally, they're all tethered on. They never untether. There's always at least two tethers, one to, you know. So that helps them. They brace themselves, and they know how to do that. Like Dick says, they do plenty of practice. Let me drop it. Years ago, with assembly, they would specifically practice for whatever thing they're doing. Now they just practice, you know, using drills, using different equipment. Because by the time they get up there, sometimes they don't know what they're going to be doing. They didn't know they were going to be changing this multiplexer, demultiplexer box out, computer relay thing. So, you know, they practice for doing all kinds of stuff, not anything specific. They'll go up and thinking that they're going to do something, and SpaceX was supposed to bring up an item one time, International docking adapter, ITER, and it blew up on the way up, and that left Jack Kelly out. He was going to attach that thing, you know. So it's left up to the next astronaut. So that's the way they do things now. They train, and specifically for how to use all the different tools, but not necessarily on a certain project that they have to install back in there.
My guess is whenever an astronaut's doing an EVA, the instant he leaves the airlock, he attaches some kind of a carabiner-like thing between him and whatever is nearby. You have to stay attached at all times. An astronaut that starts floating free is really in a lot of trouble. To recapture him, you have to move the hold-on space station in his direction, which would be very difficult. To your knowledge, Paul, has any astronaut ever come close to being unattached for any period of time? WS2N, K2LIW?
No, it's not by accident. They practiced in the shuttle bay when they first started in. It's called the SAFER unit, acronym for nothing but a jetpack, a nitrogen-fired jet that they learn how to control. So if they do float away from the station, they can use these jets to reorient themselves and get back to the space station. Every astronaut has a safer pack attached to there. The special pack that's after you get your spacesuit on and have all your equipment on, one of the last things they attach before you go out the doors is a safety unit attached to kind of like goes around your whole backpack. All kinds of little jets all over.
Any idea of how much thrust for how many seconds they can get out of the safer unit?
I don't know the time, no, I don't know. I know they practiced quite a bit, first couple of times in shuttle, but naturally they were tethered, you know, and eventually they untethered one guy to see if how he would do. But, you know, they only kept him in the shuttle bay, and the other guy was standing right by, he could have grabbed, you know. But years ago they used the manned maneuvering unit, that was a much bigger unit. And they would go out and capture satellites and bring them back to the cargo bay. They did that for, you know, maybe four different flights or so. But then they stopped that. Running out of time. WS2.
Yeah, we are out of time. That was TechNet 1652. Space report number 252. Bye bye, you all. Be kind to each other. We intend to be back next week. 73. K2IW clear. Over to you, Paul, for any final comments.
I will be here, hopefully next week. And Joe always has great questions, technical questions, space questions. Wow, very good. Back to you, Dick, and I'm going. Bye bye. 73, guys.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
W2HL. Listening. Yes, I do. I copy about 35 words per minute. Probably a little more on CW in my head. So how are you this morning, Richard? I didn't expect. I just got a fling in my head to pick up the phone, see what the latest news was. And you know, I said to myself, I don't have the radio in front of me, so I might as well see what's doing. Throw my call out on Echo Link. So I'm surprised you came back. Back to you, W2HL. You said the repeater goes down after the tech net, so, and it comes up at 5. So how are we talking on the repeater? Must be on. Yeah. So you heard me on the radio. You didn't know that I was on Echo Link until I told you, right? What's a different beat, okay. I know that. Okay, Richard. Well, I am having difficulty sleeping, too. I was watching a concert on television, Shania Twain, on Access TV. AXS TV, I think. And I saw it in the programming. I like her music. And her, too. I checked out her concert. It was live. It was a concert that was recorded in Las Vegas. It was very well produced, a very excellent, extravagant concert that she had. I didn't know that she was born in Ontario, and she's one of my, on my favorites list as far as singers. So, yeah, Dayton was nice. Dayton was very nice. I don't know if there's a timer on this situation here. The band has been open. I was on 10 meters earlier. Made a couple of 10-meter contacts today. That was pretty good. And yesterday, 20 meters, boy, it was 20 meters is open, wide open. Back to you. I'm here. Are you on Echo Link or are you on the radio? I didn't buy anything. Well, no. Let's see. I was going to buy more, but I didn't have adequate plans to go on a buying spree, because I could tell that because of the fact that I didn't have the necessary carrying cases and I bought something, you know, how to carry it. There were various people that had these suitcases, what do you call them, parts that you can pull. So I didn't have that, so I didn't really, and we got there, we sort of got there, spent 2 days there, and we got to the flea market, got to this, to the show, like around 12 or 1 o'clock each day, so, which really wasn't enough time. We should have, the next time I go, I'm going to make it so we're bright and early, because the time goes very quick, so I really don't have time to look around. Extended way, but I did buy, this guy was selling military masks. I purchased a bag of military masks, 5'8" of them in a bag, military, and I purchased them. That was all I bought. I really didn't, just went to see the show. I really didn't have, really didn't see anything that I needed. I really didn't need anything. I was just like looking around, basically. I have column stuff that I wanted to sell, but I was thinking of bringing it out there to sell. I figured I didn't really want to sit around and waste time and not see anything and just, you know, I could sell it easy on eBay. Back to you. Yeah, no, I want to buy one. I want to buy a DMR. Radio, a Motorola Turbo. Maybe I'll get that as a look around. I really don't know that much about DMR. Yeah, I was thinking of getting an HT first, but I think I should get like a mobile radio instead of an HT DMR. Yeah, I'll check that out. I'll check it out. So, very good. So how was your Memorial Day?
Next, tonight at 8:30, W2VL, repeater system.
Oh, okay, that sounds nice. There was a air show that I would have liked to see, but I couldn't get out there. I don't like crowds, but I'm sure that it was possible to view the air show from possibly a non-central vantage point. Didn't want to get stuck in traffic and all that stuff, so I didn't go. But there'll probably be an air show, I think, July 4th in Coney Island, I think, from the day to the Angels. I haven't seen them in a while. There was a air show over Manhattan, I think Navy Parachuters, one of the parachuters, died because his chute didn't open or something happened. Did you hear about that? It was a tragic accident. One of the Navy parachuters' chute failed to operate. He was killed. I think it was over somewhere in New York. I think it was over.